Today is Wednesday, May 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the World Health Organization warns that as nations fight COVID-19, other risks, particularly in children, may be getting overlooked.
We cannot let our fight against one disease come at the expense of long-term progress in our fight against other diseases. We cannot exchange one deadly outbreak for another.
Brazil now has the world's most coronavirus deaths, surpassing the U.S. Also ahead, Twitter begins fact-checking in light of recent tweets by President Trump. It's all on today's International Edition. The World Health Organization says South America is the new COVID epicenter and predicts a surge in deaths across Latin America through August, particularly in Brazil. WHO head of emergencies program Mike Ryan in Tuesday's video conference warned the government of Brazil about its approval of the anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine.
Clearly, there's a concern across many of those countries, but certainly the most affected is Brazil at this point. We also note that the government of Brazil has approved the use of hydroxychloroquine for broader use, but we do point to the fact that our current clinical and systematic reviews carried out by the Pan American Health Organization and the current clinical evidence does not support the widespread use of hydroxychloroquine for the treatment of COVID-19, not until the trials are completed and we have clear results.
It's the same drug touted by U.S. President Donald Trump. And at the same news conference, Carissa Etienne, WHO Director for the Americas and head of the Pan American Health Organization, warned that the pandemic continues to weaken health systems and disrupt routine services.
We cannot exchange one deadly outbreak for another. We cannot afford to lose decades of health gains that everyone has worked so hard to achieve. We need joint, concerted efforts to put vaccinations back on track.
The WHO also warned European countries to stay vigilant and prepare their health systems as cities begin to ease lockdown restrictions and citizens feel emergency fatigue and let their guard down. With shops, hairdressers, and other places opening across Europe, business owners are working overtime to make up the lost income after 2 months of closure. Few believe this spike in pent-up business signals a post-crisis boom. Martha Vanderwolf reports from Amsterdam.
Wils Wolvers, whose salon outside of The Hague has been operating for the past 14 years, got 1,500 bookings in the days after it was announced he could reopen. After being closed for 2 months, he and his team are working around the clock to keep up.
We had to put in screens in between the washing units so we could still wash people, or else they will be sitting next to each other. And between our stations where we cut and color, we also have screens, and normally we could have 5 or 6 people at a time. So we can do half of it. So that's why we open for 7 days, including nights.
Wolvers is happy to be fully booked for the foreseeable future, but doubts the bookings will make up for the loss of income when the salon was closed. Government relief money helped his business pay for employees' salary during lockdown, but he still had to spend part of his savings on fixed costs such as insurance and mortgage. Across Europe, shops and restaurants have either opened or are preparing to open again. Restaurants are getting many reservations and people are lining up to enter non-essential shops. But the social distancing measures mean the businesses can only operate below normal capacity. Research fellow at the European economic think tank Bruegel, Simone Tagliapietra, says that despite lockdown measures easing, consumers are also spending less.
New data just released by the European Central Bank has shown that saving in Europe in the month of March are far beyond the average level of savings in the past years. People are simply saving, putting money aside. They don't know if a second wave of the contagion will come. They are unsure about the safety of their job, so they don't spend.
Small and medium-sized businesses make up 99% of all enterprises in the EU. There are 25 million of them, and they employ more than two-thirds of the EU's workforce. They are the backbone of the EU's economy, but also are the most vulnerable to external shocks like a pandemic. A survey done by SME United, an umbrella organization for Europe's small and medium-sized enterprises, shows that half of those businesses had a 50% loss of income. This number climbed up to 80% in countries harder affected by the coronavirus pandemic, like Italy and Spain. Secretary General of SME United, Veronica Willems, says that businesses have been very creative during the coronavirus lockdown to stay afloat, but still need support.
What we've noticed for the national support packages put in place, as well as for the European measures that were put in place, was that they didn't reach the entrepreneurs as fast as the entrepreneurs had hoped. What we feel is very important is a continuation of the emergency measures where needed.
The European Union is debating plans for a massive economic recovery fund that includes grants, loans, and guarantees that could total more than $2 trillion. France and Germany presented their own plans last week. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Amsterdam.
Meanwhile, EU leaders and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe held a virtual summit Tuesday on how the world can plan to go forward responsibly and collaboratively beyond the pandemic. Joining us to talk about it is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, can you give us some highlights and specifics on the goal of the summit?
One of the big issues that the Japanese government and the EU27 want is a push forward on the coronavirus vaccine. And that we're looking again at that global coronavirus response that started earlier in May when leaders reaffirmed commitment to having diagnostics and all sorts of vaccine possibilities put forward. Don't forget that proposal, they've already got some 9 billion euros to help get those antiviral medicines going, to get diagnostics going. So one aspect of that is for them all to go back to this common theme, which is any vaccine needs to be a global common good, that it's for everyone and not just for the rich nations. So they wanted to put that there. They also, both sides, wanted to put it there that they are willing to talk or even to look at the workings of the World Health Organization, not necessarily reform it, but have a look at how it's working. So it is important. And when you look at the size of these two blocks, you've got the EU on the one hand and Japan, that represents around a quarter. Their trade represents about a quarter of the world's GDP. So you're talking about two large players who are able to decide where world trade will be going as the economy is still opening up again.
And also, I know that the issue of the upcoming G7 was a topic of discussion, given that the president of the United States has invited leaders to come to the U.S. to Camp David. Looks uncertain as to whether or not that's actually happening or not, but I know they discussed that.
Yes, European nations are emerging from lockdown. They're feeling pretty positive. It's certainly a contrast from the lockdown. And you now feel they're beginning to look beyond the day-to-day, and they are looking at foreign policy. And, of course, the agenda on next month's, everyone's diaries, is that scheduled G7 meeting. And that will be the first international gathering since COVID-19. It'll be a gathering beyond national confinement. And so even though these meetings, these types of meetings can sometimes be banal and the communiques at the end, if they're issued, are often bland, this time there's a feeling that the Europeans want to sort of talk about the way the world has changed after COVID-19. They want more free trade based on reciprocity. They want climate change. They want green energy. They want transparency. And of course, they want help for African debt. So the Europeans are keen to build with the Japanese a way of going to the G7 and sticking to these principles. If you like, you could even say that they're looking for something to sell to their public so as they can attend that G7.
In other words, they want to create a message of solidarity in the face of what they could come up against here in the U.S. from President Trump?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes, on the one hand, you do have this feeling, particularly in Europe, that what with the relationship between the United States and China at the moment is not doing anyone any favors, plus plus this America First from President Donald Trump is very difficult for particularly Europeans to understand. So as this movement goes forward, the Europeans are in quite a difficult position because they can't not go to a summit. You can't back out when you are countries that are talking about multilateralism all the time. Mm. So they do need to go, because to not go or not to attend, even if it was a virtual summit, would be going against multilateralism. So they need to find a way that they can tell their public, hey, look, we're going to go there. We're going to talk about climate change, green energy, transparency. We are going to change the world after COVID-19. And we can only do that by going to these sorts of summits.
This whole situation with collaboration with a lot of these summits, not including the United States, and Europeans, of course, thinking multilaterally and knowing they have to come to the U.S., do you think that they're working toward what appears to be a new world order?
They certainly want the world beyond COVID-19 to be very different from what it was before. And they want to use this, if you like, new beginning to say, okay, let's sit down, let's look at it. So let's look at trade, let's look at how we do trade, let's look at how we live. And if you just look around Europe and you see some of the initiatives that have come up to keep cars off the road, to keep areas clean, to be talking about a green circular economy again, there you're seeing that what 10 years ago would be considered just out of the ballpark.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Italy's new contact tracing app for the coronavirus is about to be launched in a number of pilot regions. It will be available to everyone in the country on a voluntary basis and will guarantee the privacy of users. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
Starting May 29th, Italians will be able to download a contact tracing app on their mobile phones that will help combat the spread of the coronavirus. Immuni was developed at the request of Italy's Ministry of Innovation, Technology and Digital Transformation. Paolo De Rosa, its chief technology officer, says the app can speed up the process of finding people who have had contact with COVID-19.
The app is able to do that in a privacy-preserving way, so it's not like the traditional approach where you need to identify people. In this case, there is only an alerting of people that have been in contact with someone that resulted positive.
Those alerted they have come close to someone that has tested positive for the coronavirus can quickly take action and contact health authorities or their personal physician. De Rosa stresses that privacy is guaranteed, as special measures have been taken, and it would be extremely difficult to identify anyone using the app. The only data that a user must provide is the territorial province to which he belongs. For the app to be fully effective, De Rosa said, there needs to be a significant amount of people using it, up to 60%. But that is only if one does not take into consideration other factors like social distancing. In any case, De Rosa is convinced that it will be a useful tool to have on one's phone.
This is a very bleeding-edge technology. Very few countries in the world have used it.
Creating the app was no easy matter, De Rosa said, adding that trade-offs had to be made between the requirements of health authorities and privacy. Knowledge was shared with many other countries as well, but no one really knew what the best app needed to look like. With such a highly infectious virus, the need for a tool that would help speed up contact tracing was considered essential to break the chain of contagion. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The coronavirus has hit South Africa harder than any other country on the continent of Africa. So far, it has infected more than 23,000 people and killed more than 480. But the disease is also impacting the mental well-being of many people coping with social isolation and the economic impacts of the virus. Franco Puglisi reports from Johannesburg.
60-year-old South African Wendy Jones hasn't been able to work for 15 years due to the debilitating mental health problems. She is not allowed to drive, and with the healthcare system focused on the outbreak of COVID-19, getting the right treatment has become a bigger challenge.
I personally feel more anxious. I get really worried. And who do I go to? Am I on the right medication? Should my medication be increased? I don't know these things. I need somebody to tell me. Your trust in the medical system as it is, it should be complete. It should be absolute, but it isn't.
As COVID-19 ramps up in South Africa, hospitals are seeing more patients suspected of having the virus. The pandemic is also causing an increase in number of mental health-related problems. But the leader of information and awareness at South Africa's Federation for Mental Health, Mazutane Modjadji, says most patients are going untreated.
While clinics and hospitals are open, very few of them still pay attention to current mental health care users during this time. And also, there is no screening for mental health during COVID-19 screening and testing.
Board member of South Africa Society of Psychiatrists, Kagiso Maroganye, says mental health care was poor even before the pandemic.
Now we are in the pandemic and you're finding yourself sort of on the back foot with an already fragile system and not knowing how to go about fixing it. But knowing this, knowing that, you know, it is a poorly resourced, poorly distributed system.
South Africa Federation for Mental Health, Modjadji agrees.
In South Africa, only 5% of the national budgets, of the national health budget, goes towards mental health services. The return on the individual report launched by the Speak Your Mind Global Campaign in April shows that in middle and low income countries such as South Africa, between 76 and 85% of the people with mental illness receive no treatment.
South Africa's mental health workers worry about the aftermath of the pandemic. South Africa has been through similar health crises before, and the impact is lasting, says psychiatrist Maruganye.
There will be some long-lasting effects on the psyche and the mental health state of the population based on what has happened before. We've had SARS, we've had MERS, we've had Ebola, and all of these have required some sort of lockdown or some sort of quarantine to take place. And studies emerging from that have found out that this has had a detrimental impact on people's mental health state. It has led to fear, it has led to frustration, it has led to grief and bereavement, it has even led to trauma.
Experts say they worry this time South Africa's struggling mental health care system will fall even further behind in meeting patients' demand. Frank Buklisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The UN Refugee Agency warns hundreds of thousands of urban refugees across the East Horn and Great Lakes region of Africa are resorting to desperate measures to survive as the economic impact of COVID-19 continues. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Government-imposed lockdowns and curfews aimed at preventing the spread of the coronavirus are restricting everyone's freedom of movement and ability to earn a living. The UN Refugee Agency says urban refugees are most seriously affected by the measures and unable to meet their most basic needs. UNHCR spokesman Charlie Yaxley says many urban refugees are at risk of exploitation and falling into debt. He warns many may be forced to take desperate measures to survive, such as engaging in transactional sex or child labor.
Urban refugees are facing job losses as businesses are forced to downsize or close due to COVID-19 restrictions. And many were daily wage workers or worked in the informal economy and were already living hand to mouth before the pandemic struck. Many urban refugees are also living in overcrowded and unhygienic conditions and are particularly vulnerable to the spread of the virus.
Yaxley says thousands of refugees in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, are crammed into squalid districts with little access to clean water, making hand washing nearly impossible. He says governments across the East Horn and Great Lakes region so far have included refugees in COVID-19 response plans. He tells VOA refugees have the same access to testing and treatment as members of the local communities.
So our call today is for governments to also ensure that refugees are included in social safety nets so that they are able to access welfare support payments, so that they are able to get assistance with meeting their basic needs, so that they're able to pay rent for their shelters, so that they're able to afford food.
The UNHCR says food imports have become more challenging because of the pandemic, causing prices to rise. Additionally, it says swarms of locusts, especially in Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia, are ravaging crops and threatening to increase hunger and poverty. The agency is urging the international community to support its emergency response plan. It says $126 million is required to provide life-saving assistance before the rapidly deteriorating situation in the region reaches a breaking point. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The Republican National Committee and two other Republican groups on Sunday filed a lawsuit against California Governor Gavin Newsom over his executive orders to use mail-in ballots for the November presidential election. California was the first state in the country to commit to sending mail-in ballots to all registered voters for the November election as a precautionary measure over coronavirus exposure. The Afghan government released hundreds of Taliban prisoners Tuesday, its single largest prisoner release since the U.S. and the Taliban signed a peace deal earlier this year. The agreement spells out an exchange of detainees between the warring sides. The Taliban had called for the truce during the Muslim holiday that marks the end of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. And J.K. Rowling is publishing a new story called The Ichabod, which will read online daily for free to help entertain children and families stuck at home. The Harry Potter author said Tuesday she wrote the fairy tale for her children as a bedtime story over a decade ago. The first two chapters were posted online Tuesday. When the book comes out in print later this year, Rowling plans to pledge royalties from the sales to projects helping those most impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. Four Minneapolis, Minnesota police officers involved in an arrest of a handcuffed black man who died in police custody Monday night were fired Tuesday, hours after a bystander's video showed the man pleading that he could not breathe as a white officer continued to press his knee into the man's neck. His death after struggling with officers immediately drew comparisons to the case of Eric Garner, an unarmed black man who died in 2014 in New York after he was placed in a chokehold by police while pleading for his life. Joining us to talk about the implications of the case is Minneapolis-based criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, the mayor of your city apologized to the black community Tuesday and said, quote, being black in America should not be a death sentence. In your legal opinion, was this death a homicide?
Yes. Yes, it was. If we look at what we have right now, is this is something that was put out on social media that took minutes to happen, with an officer kneeling on the neck of this man as he slowly collapses, as he slowly goes unconscious and ultimately dies. If you look at what these are and you look at how this works, I think by any definition, that is what you would describe this as, a homicide.
They were going after him. He was resisting arrest, something to do with counterfeit at a grocery store, but they had him subdued, likely handcuffed, begging to stop that he couldn't breathe.
Here is the problem. When they take him to the ground and they handcuff him, he stopped. He is done. There is something called a continuum of force. You use the force necessary. In this case, if somebody is subdued, if somebody is on the ground, if somebody is handcuffed, you don't have to do anything else. The fact that this officer specifically continued to keep his knee on this man's neck as he was pleading because he couldn't breathe, and then continues to do so for minutes, really says something about this. People in this city are outraged.
This is becoming an issue across the country. It has been an issue across the country with African-American men feeling like they're targeted, they're treated differently, and they're dying. We talk a lot about this, and apparently this is also an issue where you are in your city.
This is an issue for all Americans. not just for people of color, but people of color do feel targeted. I have seen this in courtrooms, standing in front of juries as they listen to what happens in case after case and trying to understand what it is to be a second-class citizen, what it is when you have the police who seem to be treating certain people one way and others fundamentally differently. And that is really what the fight is about. This is not new. Sadly, this is not over. At this point, this is being investigated by the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It's also being investigated by the FBI. The FBI is involved because there may be civil rights questions, and clearly are civil rights questions. The chief of police has fired four police officers who were apparently on the scene at this point. That's simply the start. Now they're talking about criminal charges, whether those are state or federal is still up for grabs.
So these men being fired is not the end for them. They are likely to face criminal charges.
Oh, I think at bare minimum, the officer who was kneeling on the neck of that man, I think, will be facing charges. The other three officers who sat back and simply allowed this to happen or kept everybody else away, they could be facing charges as well, based upon either conspiracy, essentially supporting the other guy, or something else. We don't know yet. The first thing that we know is that this is essentially a chokehold of sorts. Well, the fact is that these have been outlawed in Minneapolis since 1993. So the idea that this officer was doing it in the first place makes it completely and utterly inappropriate.
Minneapolis-based criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thanks so much for being with us. Twitter on Tuesday, for the first time, told readers to fact-check tweets sent by President Donald Trump. It's a dramatic shift for the social network following a number of false claims by the president, including that former Congressman Joe Scarborough may have murdered a woman two decades ago. As AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports, the tweets drew a strong reaction from the woman's husband.
Lori Klisoutis' body was found in Scarborough's Florida congressional office in 2001. She had a heart condition, and medical officials ruled she hit her head after fainting and did not suspect foul play. But the president's repeatedly tried to implicate Scarborough, now an MSNBC host and a fierce Trump critic. Timothy Klisoutis says the president's tweets violate Twitter's rules and should be removed, saying the president is among conspiracy theorists spreading bile and disparaging his wife's memory. Twitter says it's deeply sorry the statements are causing pain, but did not say it will do anything about the president's tweets. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Andrea Bocelli has revealed that he had COVID-19 and has since recovered. The Italian tenor says he's donated plasma for research this week for potential coronavirus treatments. Some current coronavirus patients have received plasma from former patients as part of their treatment to boost recovery. The singer spoke outside of the hospital after donating the plasma, telling reporters that he had suffered only mild symptoms. On Easter Sunday, Bocelli sang solo in Milan's empty Duomo Cathedral during the lockdown in Italy, the country where the COVID-19 outbreak began in Europe. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us on voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Take care of yourselves and be well. Sogno all'orizzonte manca le parole, e io solo so che sei con me, la mia luna tu sei qui con me, io solo tu sei qui con me. What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics.
show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.